you're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
This week's Dialect Radio. The show has come to you from the studio just off Queen Square in the centre of Bristol and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to you all in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and all over the world, including South America. We have two studio guests this week. Mary Tapping is an NUJ journalist and she's here to talk about the credit crunch. Josie Hill joins us from the 125 charity to talk about the forthcoming Night Walk on the 13th of June and how you can get involved. And the Bolsheviks are here and they'll be playing some of their music, and we have features from Tony and Anthea, our Dialect reporters. Malcolm Grieve also reads the third instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. And that's set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. Jess Box, as ever, is here to bring us the latest in what's going on in and around Bristol. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I'd like to welcome to the studio Mary Tapping. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
You're a freelance journalist, I understand.
That's right. I used to be a staff reporter, staff writer, and I've now gone on to the freelance side because mainly of the cutbacks in the industry.
Okay. How do you find your values and your approach to life has been affected by the credit crunch?
Well, I like to think I'm a fairly positive person. As a friend of mine put it, rather optimistically, well, if there's a credit crunch and people can't afford to go out so much, then possibly they'll read more.
Okay.
which is all to the good from a writer's point of view.
Yeah.
But I think that there are two ways you can look at it. You can, the credit crunch, that is, you can either say, oh, woe is me, and think of the bad ways in which it's affecting you, or you can look on it as a way forward and an opportunity to try out new things.
Yeah. Now, you've given me like a little couple of quotes that you came with on a piece of paper that you felt were important to you. You said that the Chinese symbol for crisis comprises of two characters, danger and opportunity. What are you sort of doing? How have you changed your life? What sort of new sort of things are you trying out? And how has that come about as a part of the credit crunch?
I'm not so sure that they're all specifically new things, but they're things which perhaps got put on the back burner because of necessity as one grows up, gets into a career, etc. And I think it's important for people to hang on to the sort of things that they found stimulating when they were 9 or 10, the dreams they had.
Yeah.
And then you get into exams and teenage angst and all that sort of thing, and somebody says you should do so and so, that's a good career, and so you do it. And 30 years down the line, you probably decide either it wasn't what you wanted to do in the first place, or you've had enough of that and you'd rather do something else. But most people need a kick up the bum before they actually make any significant changes. And I would like to think that the credit crunch did that for me.
So what did you used to dream about all those years ago when you were a child that you sort of imagined yourself doing that you suddenly kind of in recent times have felt disappointed that maybe you hadn't done?
I'm not so sure I'm disappointed in it, for reasons I'll explain in a moment, but I did at one point harbour an ambition to be a vet. And then as I got older and realism kicked in, I realised that you needed 3 or 4 rather high-grade science A-levels. And I didn't think the selectors at vet school would be too impressed with English and music.
Right.
So, first of all, I went in for teaching and then swapped over into journalism. Now, during all that time, in the background, there's always been this interest in various complementary therapies. Because although I respect great greatly the things that vets do. I don't always like all of them, and I think there's another side, a holistic side, to treating animals.
Okay. I understand you've been trying out a full spectrum healing course. What is full spectrum healing?
Full spectrum just means that it's exploring all the different ways of healing. So you're not looking at one specific angle like crystal healing or something like that. You're looking at the whole range over a period, well, in this case, 2 years. And it's a great thing for self-exploration, really, getting to know yourself better. I think that's quite an important element of not being in the 9-to-5 job. You do have the opportunity to explore different aspects of life that you wouldn't necessarily do when you came home exhausted at the end of the day and just wanted to have a glass of wine and go to sleep.
I kind of have this this image in my mind, a little bit like The Good Life, the sort of the couple who kind of wanted to make a go of sort of various alternative ways. Is this sort of perhaps, I don't know, are you the sort of the 21st century equivalent?
Yes, probably. Yeah. I keep thinking I should have an allotment and things, and there is a patch of my mother's garden I could very well use for that. The only problem is I don't like vegetables very much. I could
never be a
vegetarian. And so I think, well, perhaps I should keep hens then. Well, I don't like eggs either, so there's not much point in doing that. But I do think that there is a strong case for getting back to basics, living life as it is, rather than this false sense of values that seem to have developed over the years. And now the whole of the synthetic world that we've constructed over the last few decades is now crumbling around our ears, and it's down to us to find our own way through it.
So what are you doing to sort of try and get out there and encourage other people to sort of see the credit crunch from the same point of view that you're coming from?
I've got an idea for a magazine I'd like to start along those lines, and I'm looking for a backer at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, from my own point of view, I'm very much following my own maxim of when in doubt, retreat into horses and music. But also, I'll always be a journalist, and I would like to develop this magazine. So, for instance, perhaps somebody who's been in corporate finance in London for 30 years wakes up one morning and thinks, I can't do this anymore, it doesn't mean anything to me, whether or not they've been forced out of a job.
Yeah.
And they might prefer to make a total life change and move somewhere remote and farm alpacas. Or at the other end of the scales, somebody might prefer to stay with what they've got in terms of a job, a lifestyle, but bring in something extra, like learning an instrument that perhaps they've always wanted to do, or do what I'm doing and do the healing course. Or there's also a thing, I can't remember the name of it now, but it's rather like voluntary service overseas, except instead of going away for a year, you go for a fortnight or a month, and it's like a holiday. You pay for it to go there.
Yeah.
But instead of bronzing yourself on the beach, you use whatever skills you've got to help the local community.
Okay.
Over there.
Yeah. How you kind of spoke when we kind of chatted previously about degrees of change. How many sort of, what does that mean? Are there certain sort of a number of degrees of change before somebody sort of becomes a sort of adopts a new lifestyle? How many sort of degrees of change do you believe there to be? What does that mean?
Well, I think you can look at that in two ways. One is what I think you're meaning, where you come to a realization of what you actually want to do by degrees and perhaps make changes gradually. And sometimes that's the best thing to do. If a lorry driver wants to become a homeopath, he might continue being a lorry driver and study in his spare time, and then having qualified practice for one day a week, then it might build up to two. So over a period of time, he could make the complete change. Or the examples I gave you of the extreme change and the partial change, you could have degrees in between, different degrees to which people felt they wanted things to change.
Okay, so you've got an idea for a magazine. What contact have you made with other people who are of a like mind up until now?
Quite a lot. Obviously, with the work I've been doing, I've got an extensive notebook, if you like, contacts book of people. I know people all over the place. If you want the fax number for Buckingham Palace, I've got it. But I wasn't actually planning to include that in my plans. But I've spoken to a lot of people and drawn in quite a few widely differing ideas already, which would start us off.
Okay.
And the idea would be to perhaps have two or three features, case studies, call them what you will, and then some general features about these various things. It would bring in a lot of advertising, and I think it would be a goer.
What examples could you perhaps give us about people you've met who are already sort of undertaking the same sort of changes that you've undertaken?
It's very difficult to say, really. I'm not sure that the people concerned would really want me to...
But you've met people that you perceive the credit crunch has done what it's done to you. It's made them take stock of things and take a new approach.
Yes.
Yeah.
It hasn't always been the credit crunch, I have to say. It's maybe a time of life or whatever, but certainly... There's a wide range of people with a wide range of ideas and ambitions that they're exploring how viable these things would be. And I think most of them will go down that road.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in, and I wish you very best of luck with your magazine. Would it have a name or an online entity, or are you still sort of in the very early planning stages?
I'm still in the very early planning stages. I haven't thought of a name. That would obviously be... In consultation with any backer, but I have got a couple of people interested. One is a well-known magazine publisher, and the other is a local entrepreneur.
Okay.
I mean, really, I'd prefer to go down the second route, because that would give me more control over it and ownership of the idea. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay, well, I'm sure in future shows we'll be able to keep in touch and just sort of see what's going on with the magazine.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Bristol City Council seem to have lost interest in managing their housing stock. Jim White is one of Bristol's longest-standing tenant reps, and he's grown cynical about their will to manage property. He also has some strong ideas about how council management needs to change.
In recent times, we've set up new service user groups. So we've got caretaking estates, heating, and there's about six service user groups. And I attend them, as many as I can, but I don't win. And they just discuss changes, proposals, things for the future. That's all pie in the sky, because you can talk. They're talking shops. Yeah, just naturally. Yeah, well, we'll look at that, we'll look at that, we'll look at this, we'll look at that. 3 months down the line, you get a reply, well, we've looked at this, but the money's not available. And then the biggest excuse for the lot came last December with a credit crunch. And I keep saying, the council still get the revenue for the flats and houses, irrespective of people are earning money or not, because income support pay the bills. Bristol Council are lucky they have a continual revenue stream on their stock. There's very few properties empty. And I cannot see why this money cannot be spent more wisely. Makes sense.
Can you envisage more problems with this in the future? And I wonder if maybe the fact that you're having problems with the council means that people are more likely to eventually say, well, actually, we've had enough of being managed and owned by the council. We want either a TMO or we want a housing association to take over.
I've been down the TMO route. I've looked at TMOs. They work in small blocks, i.e. Redcliffe Hill would be ideal for a TMO. But to take on acquired housing stock and council housing, which is now, we're saying Knoll, for example, it was all council housing 50 years ago, two-thirds are now private. To look after individual houses piecemeal is difficult. TMOs, nah. Federation we've looked at, and have you heard about the Bristol Federation? We tried to get that going. And dear Tony Lewis, who died a few weeks ago, you remember Tony Lewis? Yeah, good friend of mine. We've tried the Federation, and we may bring it back, because a Federation would look at, be a Federation of all tenants and residents looking at the problems that concern everybody. And that could work. But regardless, the problem is, to have an effective organisation, apart from the Council for Housing, you need fundraisers, you need good managers. I would dread to employ ex-council employees because they're entrenched in traditional no money. You've got a fresh start. And to get people with fresh initiatives to look after housing is very difficult. It's a very, very expertise area. It's not easy. Housing associations do it a different way. They have money from the council, from the housing corporation. A different ball game. But social housing run by the council is a completely different animal.
Right, now this estate we've got here around us, I mean, it looks in reasonable condition to me.
This has just had a refit. New bathrooms, new kitchens, outside and a new roof. A massive injection of cash. And I would say this is one of the good things to come from partnership with private companies, because they can bulk buy, get things cheaper and do a good job.
So who is actually running this then? Who runs and owns this?
This is run by Bristol City Council.
And they've had a partnership with a private company here?
Yeah, Waits and Rock, who do all the capital investments. This is called a capital investment, this programme here. This is just millions of pounds. And then if they save on it, the money goes back to the council. If they save on the whole expenditure.
And how many people are actually living here? How many flats?
Quite a few. I say in this little block here, about 300 flats, and most of them are occupied.
Well, I should hope so.
Yeah, and that reiterates what I said before. They're occupied, so obviously they have a revenue stream to pay for all this. Why can't it be done elsewhere?
Okay, so how do you see the future panning out in the next few years for council tenants? Do you think things are going to get better or what?
I think things won't improve until tenants grab hold of the knuckle and say, we want a standard, and the council's got to go up to that standard. Now, to get a standard, you've got to take the worst and the best and come halfway, obvious common sense. But it needs people to look at the best properties in Bristol run by the council and the worst, say, right, we want to aim for that, but no, we'll go halfway. And that's the only way you're going to go forward.
So if you were the Director of Housing at the City Council and you had to wave your magic wand, what one thing do you think you'd do to try and start things on the road to recovery?
I think I'd like to see more council guys out in the field talking to tenants and asking what they want. They've started to do it, but as yet I've seen no response. You've got to get out there. Like the old rent man, hello missus, 25 shillings for your rent, fine. Everything okay? Fine. Oh, next door neighbour's garden's untidy. Right, we'll check that. Personal contact. Do it on the spot. And if the tenants see this, I think they'll take more pride in their own home as well.
And what about the whole issue of caretakers? Because you said earlier about years ago or so, that was when the caretakers' flats were closed and rented out and they were moved out. Do you think that affects things a lot?
Of course, because when I moved to Duckmore Road, we had a caretaker per block. It's now got two caretakers for three blocks. It's envisaged we'll have one caretaker for three blocks. And they'll be bringing in help from other areas and all that, like a flying squad of cleaners. No, I think a caretaker was intrinsically part of the block. He was there. And people felt safe, security was there. And he knew everybody in the block and knew all the problem families. How to deal with it? That's gone forever. I'm sorry, but once you do away with...
No, you see, I've just told you, you're Director of Housing now, so you can do anything you want.
If I was Director of Housing, all right, I'd go back, look at the drawing board where they built Hartcliffe, Knoll, a lot after the war, see how it was being run then, take the good points from that, regardless of cost, and try and implement it. And I think people want to see the council housing run by council people properly, not outside companies. That's my view.
Jim White there, who's been a council tenant almost all of his life, giving his rather stern appraisal of Bristol City Council's ability to manage its housing stock. Well, within the very quiet and beige confines of the studio, we have two leather-clad black rockers who look decidedly out of place. I'd like to welcome Louis and Lux from the Bolsheviks.
Good evening.
Splendid. Louis, you're the guitarist, I understand, and Lux, you're all vocals. Cool. How many of you are there in total?
Five in the band in total. The rest were too lazy to come down tonight. So, yeah, that's Lee on bass, Austin on drums, and Bobby on the other guitar. Yeah. So.
Okay. How long have you been going?
Ooh, it's got to be 6 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, 6 years.
That's yeah. Now, definitely.
So have you always sort of, are you both sort of local Bristol lads, are you? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, different sides of Bristol, aren't we? I'm sort of originally from South Bristol.
Yeah.
Sort of real, sort of rough end, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I'm from the posh end.
Yeah.
Artcliffe.
No, yeah, I'm from that end, basically, originally. And he's from the other end, South or South Gloss kind of thing. We just fairly, it's just nothing and nothing, really. Yeah.
How long have you always been in lots of bands? Is this your newest incarnation of a long line of variety of stuff?
We've all been in and out of, excuse me, in and out of bands, haven't we?
Yeah, I've been in sort of one band before this one, Lux, and that was the only band I've ever been in, really. That was going for quite a long, long time. And we just met at a gig, really, and just went on from there. And this sort of metamorphosised what we've got now.
Would you sort of consider yourselves to be sort of part of a local scene of some sort? Or
no.
Are you? No, not at all.
No, I hate local scene. I'm not really into anything at all in Bristol, but battle of the bands and all that kind of business and playing with the Fleece and all that, because it's only it's a varied city, fragmented, but it's still small. So you can be quite big in Bristol, but that's nothing as far as I'm concerned. Because like once you know, I've always said to people in bands, yeah, but no one knows you 20 miles down the road. What's the point?
Yeah.
So I look at it in that way, really. I'd look on a bigger sort of picture. So I'm not being sort of downhearted, trying to put people down, but I never really got into it, to be quite honest with you. Because after a while, you can quite easily exhaust the playing sort of venues, and you end up sort of playing in front of people you've played before.
Yeah.
So I found it quite boring. So I tend to sort of, I've always had the philosophy, just keep going further afield, keep playing. No one knows you initially, but after a while they will. And it gets to the point where you can play basically anywhere in the UK to a degree, and someone would have heard of you.
Okay.
I've seen it that role. It takes longer, but it's more worthwhile.
So how long have you been plugging away at trying to get as far out around the UK as possible?
Well, I wouldn't call it plugging away, because plugging away makes it sound really tedious and boring. It's just the mindset, really.
Okay.
Since I was a sperm.
Since you were a zygotic, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you do a lot of gigs in London, then?
No, don't like that place either. I'll tell you a story about London. What I think about London is, because Bristol is a hard place to play.
Yeah.
There's lots of venues, but there's only a certain amount of venues which are worthwhile playing, which not guarantee an audience, but if they're half full, it's good, or three quarters full, it's good, or full is even better. To get into those places, you've got to prove yourself, but you can't prove yourself because nobody gives you a chance to get on the ladder, so it's a catch 22. But once you're there, it means that you've had to reach a certain level of sort of playing prowess, if you like, I want to call it that, to be able to play there. But when you get to London, there's bands playing these places week in, week out, and they're all local, and everyone knows who they are to a degree, but they get first hand on those venues, right. So they can just go in and play top of the bill. But any Bristol band that plays there, to a degree, are like 10 times better than London band, because they've had to prove themselves just to play in Bristol. But when you get to London, they think, oh, London's really good, but the bands there are generally speaking, but they just happen to be there.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of Bristol bands, to their credit, are a lot better than, you know, mainstream sort of the capital bands to a degree.
Louis, what sort of local bands do you have you enjoyed? What local acts are you really?
I like a band. One of my favourite bands is a band called Kill Van Helsing.
Great band.
I don't know if you've seen them. They're sort of rockabilly, psychabilly.
Yeah.
They're really great. I love them. They've been about a while. They're really good. Alien Stash Tin. I like them.
Yeah.
So, who else do we like, Paul?
Well, everyone hates us because we're so successful. There's loads of bands, but if I picked a band, then everyone would be going, oh, well, why don't you say that? You know, bands come and go. I mean, I've always liked the Moonflowers. They're not going anymore. I think they're playing a lot in sort of abroad and stuff like that. There's loads of bands. Black Chalk are quite a good band. I quite like them.
Black Chalk,
they're good.
Very good band.
Okay.
Loads and loads of bands. I mean, but there's too many to list. And I've got to the point where I don't actually go out and see a lot of bands these days because same kind of thing. Go out and you seem to know everyone.
Are you in ownership of a van that says The Bolsheviks in big letters on the side, and then you'll have airliner style seats in it?
You've been watching too much Scooby-Doo.
That's my idea of...
I try to dress down and not be noticed by anyone, to be honest. That's why I sort of live away a bit. But
that's impossible.
But it's to a degree, it's like, you know... I don't know. I mean, the trouble is, when we go out and we play, we're so used to doing what we do. We go out and do what we do, and you get other bands or other people in bands or know of other bands who are like up there, and they tend to talk to you about drums or guitar strings or the insides of microphones and the PA and the equipment and that. And to me, that's the most boring thing ever. I've lost the question though. A show, if you like, for me, is like, no matter how many people less people, loads and loads of people, my idea of a good gig is for everyone to be an extension of the best house party I've ever been to.
Okay.
Looking at that way. It's got nothing to do with the band, really. As long as everyone's having a really, really good time and enjoying themselves, and the band are feeding off the crowd and likewise, that makes it. Because people can walk away and think, oh, that was really good. Even if they hated what you've done, they've still walked out and had a good time. They'll probably see you again.
Cool.
That's what we're trying to transcend.
Okay. What are your influences?
Not being normal.
Being abnormal.
Not so much mainstream. It's like what people expect of you. You know, you go to school, you expect to go do well and become, earn lots of money and bring your family up and stuff like that in the convention. Being sort of unconventional without trying.
Yeah.
Which I've always been. I never looked on anyone to think, oh, yeah, I want to be like that. Because if people think they're actually trying, they can see it, and it's not false. It's false.
Yeah.
If it just comes from the heart, and, you know, it's like when we're playing, none of us look at each other, we just do what we're doing. It's like, oh, yeah, you've got to play this. No, hey, hey. None of this business. Yeah. Just do what you got to do, and that's it.
Okay.
Natural.
What gigs have you got coming up soon? I understand you're playing in Swindon. I think that's on the 12th of June. What other future plans have you got?
I think we're in Cornwall, sort of all down the south, really, aren't we? For the
rest of the summer, really.
Yeah, for the rest of the summer. Down by the seaside.
Yeah. Rather, that's the same kind of thing, you see, because people expect to go to in London or in Manchester and stuff like that. But why go somewhere where the buildings and people are just moaning about life in there all the time and being really dreary? And then when you finish the gig, it's not safe to walk anywhere and things like that. People think they're like termites or something. Go somewhere where it's nice so you can. People are enjoying themselves, and when you walk somewhere and look at the scenery, it's cool.
Mm. You know, nice.
That's how we look on it.
Sounds like a good life. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming into the studio, and it's nice. I like having musicians in. It's always great. Thank you very much, and I wish you best luck.
Cheers. Excellent, and you. Enjoy yourself. Passing down within a lunar moon and power that's crushing my mind. I've got
Josie Hill has come straight from an awards ceremony in London. Eagle-eared listeners will have spotted that we have interviewed her before. The 125, or the 125 charity, which supports vulnerable women, sex workers on the streets of Bristol, has won the Integrated Health Award, a sum of £5,000, which is organised by the Prince's Foundation for Integrated Health and is sponsored by the Department of Health. Josie's here in the studio to tell us about the forthcoming Night Walk, and that's happening on the 13th of June, organised by the 125 charity. Hello, Josie. Congratulations.
Hello. Thank you very much. I hope I talk properly today, because I'm a bit tired from talking so quickly to people like Roger Daltrey from The Who today.
Name-dropping, nice.
Name-dropping all over the place, and Prince Charles himself.
Okay, who was more exciting to meet?
I couldn't possibly say on radio. I listen to more of The Who's music than Prince Charles's music, but
okay.
Then I'm a big fan of his Elderflower Cordial, so, you know, it's up to you to decide.
And his very expensive biscuits.
His very expensive biscuits when I give them at Christmas.
Okay.
I've come straight from there. We're massively delighted to win the England Awards, because it's just such great recognition of the work we do. As you say, we're supporting around 200 women in Bristol who are desperate to break free from their life of sex work and drug addiction and homelessness on the street. Mm-hmm. And part of that is trying to raise funds to keep us going. And so we launched something called the Night Walk last year. It was very exciting. It was the first one of its kind in Bristol. And we managed to raise over £7,000 in sponsorship money. So this June the 13th, which is a Saturday night,
yep,
we're doing it again. We're asking people to sign up for it and turn up on the night, hopefully with some raised sponsorship money, but no minimum, and either do the 5 mile walk or the full 10 mile challenge, which is a figure of eight around Bristol's most iconic sites.
Okay.
I should also mention that this year there's a summertime theme, so we're inviting people to dress up in however they decide that summertime theme should be interpreted. We've got people from local drugs agencies. They've said they might be coming as Grease characters.
Nice.
We've got other people coming bizarrely as Famous Five characters, and all sorts of funny things. So that'll be a sight to see for Bristolians who might be out at between 8 and 8 p.m. and 1 a.m. on the Saturday the 13th.
Okay, brilliant. So you won the award for England. How many other sort of charities were you sort of competing against? How big a deal is this?
Well, we were told that they shortlisted it to over 100 strong entrants. They didn't mention how many feeble entries there were, actually, and I didn't want to ask. But no, it was very exciting. There were some great ones in there. There was Sara Lee Trust, Age Concern, some really good names. So we were absolutely delighted to have won it.
Okay, what are you going to do? Do you think £5,000 is probably a lifesaver, really, for the amount of money to have?
It's funny you say lifesaver, because one of our the first points, the first services we give out to the women is our outreach van. That's been running for about 13 years now,
right,
and has been described by the women as a lifesaver and a turning point in their life. It goes out 5 nights a week and provides them with food, condoms, healthcare, all sorts of things. And actually our trusty yellow van broke down a couple of months ago and did not pass its MOT, so probably be putting the money towards keeping that going.
Okay, brilliant.
Getting a new van and sending it out there again.
Okay, so start your imaginations going. There's a night walk on the 13th of June. Where are you sort of meeting? Where is the starting point for it?
The meeting point is at the Arc, which is on Cotton Road South in Kingsdown. There's directions and all that on our website, which is on www.125.org.uk. 125 is spelled O-N-E, the number 2, number 5. You can also go onto our registration site at Just Giving, which is www.justgiving.com/125nightwalk, and you can sign up there. It's £5, and you will send out registration pack and get lots of free delicious refreshments on the night.
Bargain. Brilliant. Thank you very much, Josie Hill, and congratulations once again.
Thanks very much.
It's time now for the third instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Grieve. A story set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. If you remember from last week, in 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Navy Volunteer Pub in Bristol. If you would like to play with them, they meet every Tuesday for an impromptu music session, and you can just turn up and join in. And that's in King Street, which is where the Old Vic Theatre is.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. The Farmers. As for the farmers' meanness, selfishness, and all that's irreconcilable, we had so much of it in the first years that even now, when we have been boycotted, to use their own term, for 5 years, the sight of market day opens wounds. The old spread has always been the farmers' home, was their cry, when I told them that I would have to change their one-day-a-week market room into a dining room for everyday use, whilst giving them a much better room across the archway. And I showed them my books to prove that to do otherwise would be ruin. But they had no mercy. We argued for hours together about it. On market day, as many as 60 farmers, dealers and corn merchants, there are six now, wolfed a 4 shilling and 6 pence dinner here for 2 shillings and 6 pence a time, and I had to put before them 3 different kinds of joints, which they carved themselves. Meanwhile I looked on and thought and felt like Penelope and the suitors. Once, before delivering a helping, I ran it out into the kitchen to weigh it. 1 slice weighing 1 pound and 3 ounces from the thick of a boiled leg of mutton. A rent audit dinner used to be held upstairs in what is now number 12 bedroom. "What's that room doing now?" asked a much-respected farmer soon after their clearing out. "It's had people sleeping in it for 6 weeks. And next year it will be empty," was his gracious prophecy. Another farmer of first rank used to complain to the parlour-maid about not having enough fish. So, happening once to see him as he sat down, I quite kindly asked him to explain his difficulty. When, before 6 people in the room, he roared out apropos of nothing, "Well, you're the biggest liar on earth and a traitor to the country." I persuaded him, perfectly sober, to leave the room, and 5 minutes afterwards I met him again in the butcher's shop. "You're a dirty German and a damned man." I now told him that if he spoke again I would... And he dried up, never to speak to me again. Poor good man. He was only letting out in his own way the concentrated feeling against me of the farmer clan. I tried my best to understand them, and some of them perhaps tried to understand me, but it didn't work. They are medieval, and they treated me as an interloper from 300 years later. Those few that remain I like. Some of them like me. The rest disregard me. The total of the Christmas collection for my 2 market room waiters from 10 regular customers amounted once to 3 shillings and 9 pence for serving 524-course dinners. Well, I couldn't help expostulating with the 2 of them who had given nothing. They were obdurate. There is no collection now. Mr. X, a big farmer, came into my office with this. "Mr. Fothergill, that strong beer you sold me was bad, poor stuff. And I recommend you not to sell it to any of us farmers, and I am not going to pay you the whole £5.10 for it." I now decided to wrangle with or give way no more to farmers. So I pulled myself together and said, "You must pay. And I'd remind you that it's just 9 months since you had the beer, and my profit is only a few shillings." After a lot of argument, he paid in full. I had to fill in his cheque for him to sign, which is the custom here. Doubtless this was necessary in earlier days because they couldn't write, or often enough couldn't hold a pen. But now it is from laziness, and the satisfying feeling of seeing the dealer doing some more work for his pay. And at the same time, you give him a drink. The next market day, he came up to me with a pleasant, knowing smile. "Mr. Fothergill, that beer was like wine. I don't know how it could be made like that nowadays." And all that manoeuvre, just to beat me down 1 shilling or 2. I believe these tactics are called leg-pulling. But I think only when it doesn't come off. He never asked for any more beer. Thinking that I ought to try to persuade the farmers that I was not the sophisticated, ill-meaning person they thought me, I advertised in the bar, "Wanted, 30 good men
to eat the following dinner on Saturday, January the 20th, 1923. Tomato soup, fish, brown stew, venison, jugged hare, plum pudding, toasted cheese, filberts. 4 shillings a head. I prepared for the 25 who said they would come, and only 13 came. 2 bottles of whisky were bought, which gave me a profit of 3 shillings, and whilst the meal just paid expenses. They were very pleasant, and perhaps were doing their best to forget that I was an interloper, and, for the moment at least, to realise old times. The venison was in an almost solvent state when it went into the oven, but solid was the stench all over the house when it was cooking. It was all eaten. Romilly John had just arrived here, and his pleasant smile, neat fringe, slouch and untidy belcher instead of collar were very popular, even if I wasn't. It was his father's idea that I should teach him innkeeping. It was Romilly's idea to teach it to me. So after the venison feast, he and I argued with all the passion of a theological discussion how best to carry an oblong tray, whether by its breadth or length, till 2:30 a.m. When I was quite broken down, we went to bed, only to argue again the next night about his fad of mead and exclusively home-grown products, and so on. Romilly must have thought me very loathsome to take him so seriously. Fat Stock Show Dinner. We used to do the annual Fat Stock Show Dinner organised by the auctioneers. We gave frightfully good food, and the plum puddings were made from E.P. Warren's extravagant American recipe. And a horde of elderly, curious-looking waitresses came over in a one-horse van from Aylesbury in the charge of Mrs. Balls. Finding after accurate costing that at 5 shillings a head we made only 10 shillings profit on the food, and for that they drank little and complained much, I told the auctioneers I would be quite glad if they would go elsewhere, if they wanted to, and take with them the memory of some raw boiled mutton that, unfortunately, had been served them the last time, and had left its rawness upon some of them ever since. However, I wrote to the county chairman of the proceedings, saying that I was sorry for his and a few others' sake, that they should have to move to the town hall, and fare less well in that gaunt place. He wrote me a charming letter in reply. In his speech at the dinner, it was reported to me that he spoke differently. "If John Fothergill doesn't want us, we damn well don't want him." Applause. So I wrote and asked him if he'd really said what I'd been told, and I had no reply. Once, when this masterpiece of feudal survival was being driven in an hired car, an old woman got in the way, and they had to slow up. Up he sprang to his feet, purple in the face with rage, and shouted, "You damned old fool! You damned old fool! If I had my gun with me, I'd shoot you!" And I'm sure that this was not like the rage of an upstart because his progress had been impeded, but because he felt that the woman had acted stupidly in her own interest and deserved the extreme penalty for it. But it is not difficult to sympathise with these difficult farmer people. The farmers didn't like to be ousted from where they had been for generations before the war, and for which they had once paid properly. I came just after the war. And in their own simple way, they thought it was I, and not the circumstances, that was the cause of raising the prices and bringing in a new clientele. Though I didn't raise the 2 shillings and 6 pence dinner, and I lowered the price of spirits. Neither they nor the people nor the shopkeepers welcomed the sight of people with energy to shame their slow ways. To tell them that to support us here and to brighten up their houses would be to make themselves and their heirs richer was gratuitous, because they are happy as they are, and their heirs would be likewise. I don't regret our first awful years of strife here, but I am grateful now to be almost as peaceful as my fellow townsmen.
Thank you very much to Malcolm, and you can hear part 4 next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with Tony from Southville, who works for the Bristol Lesbian, Gay and Bisexual Forum.
My name is Tony. We're at the Tobacco Factory for the launch of the book.
What's the name of the book?
The name is called Becoming Drusilla by Richard Beard, which is about the transition of Drusilla from Andrew to Drusilla. I'd expected it to be very much about Richard's prejudice. I expected it to be about his prejudice, his resistance to the transition Andrew made into Drusilla, but it wasn't. It was about him examining his own prejudice about gender identity, trying to get his head round how Andrew was morphing into Drusilla and almost playing the Deus Ex Machina, looking at the way that Drusilla was learning to be the person she was inside.
But it's not a new sickness, is it?
It isn't. I think there has always been conflict within human beings about what their true identity is. The world tries to impose on us an external identity, and yet so many people, you can see it in the way they move, in the way they talk, in their sensibilities, that they may not be entirely comfortable within the gender that their physical body has assigned them. And with Drusilla, I find it entirely comfortable. It is a different and a new take to have another voice other than the protagonist to commentate on how that transition, how a friend views that transition, how they see that morphing, the way that we might observe a caterpillar turning into a butterfly, but from the outside. And yet, at the same time, knowing that person very intimately and seeing how all the traits that they had once identified as male are nothing more than perhaps a female that likes boys' things.
But do you think it's more the person who has the problem rather than the public? I mean, a lot of people worry, do they, whether if a man turns into a woman and, as I say, chooses to be a woman. Well, I think people are quite more-minded about that now, aren't they?
I think some people are, but I think if we are honest, a lot of people have problems, and each and one, every one of us, in the privacy of our own heads, have to question, do I have a problem with that? Because we all like to believe ourselves to be liberal and open-minded, but actually a lot of us are really quite oldy-worldy and all foggy. I think, in fact, this liberalism we anoint ourselves with is just a mask. I think a lot of us are prejudiced, and I think society is trying to wear a whole lot of masks on its sexual and gender fascism. There is an identity which you're supposed to conform with, and if you do not, you are a novelty, an amusement, but not somebody I would really like my children to hang out with. Not really somebody I would like to invite to dinner. Because I come across that all the time. And I had to work hard on my notion of, well, you know, how can these people be women? They were born men. They didn't experience their childhood as women. They didn't experience childbirth. How can they possibly know what it's like to be a woman? But then how do I know what it's like to be a woman? I only know my own feelings. I don't know how other women feel. And perhaps this is more about how each and every one of us knows ourselves to be, rather than as other people see us. And that's what Richard was telling us in this book. I knew I was a lesbian since I was 9 years old, but the world had a problem with it. I had my front teeth broken because of it. My daughter was attacked because of it and had her front teeth broken because of it. And in fact, she experienced that in Bristol. I experienced it in London. But that is nothing compared to what a lot of transsexual people experience. Because if you think that homophobia is bad, transphobia is perhaps 10 times worse. A lot of men somehow seem to express their disagreement with transsexual men and women by seeking to obliterate them altogether. And there is a history of horrific violence towards transgender people. And this is where lesbian, gay and bisexual people and transgender people company perhaps stands together and realise that sexual embodied fascism is exactly that, fascism, a form of authoritarianism that religion and social mores have imposed on us, not because there is a natural order. In fact, biology teaches us that homosexuality is pretty normal in most species. But gender identity, we can't ask animals about gender identity. All we can do is to ask people, who do you think you are? And perhaps what we need to do is to just accept who they say they are. What sort of sanction does society intend to impose on people who do not conform? That choice is very often met with ostracism, at the very least, and violence at the very worst, murder in some societies. In our own society, transgender people are very often met with the most outrageous violence. And we know for a fact that there are many transgender people who commit suicide, one, because they cannot continue to live within the gender that they were assigned by biology, but two, because the society around them meets them with such horrific hostility, and that includes the lesbian, gay and bisexual community. And I think that on both sides of both the gender and the sexual orientation camps, we need to ask ourselves, what right does anybody have to impose our views on who they are?
That was Anthea Page talking to Tony about the book just released called Becoming Drusilla. Drusilla Marling, the subject of the book, written by Richard Beer, will be here in the studio on the 3rd of June. Jeff Sparks is back from his trip up north last week to bring us what's going on in Bristol.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday 22nd of May, the Hamsters will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on 22nd of May, The Last In Days, We Are Guitar Guitar and Jokanovic will all be performing at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week and our feature, Voice Squad. This group formed in Bristol in 1978 and split up in 1985. Then in 1997, the group came back with a new lineup and still perform to this day. This is a track from the album Rich and Famous. It's a track titled I Am. We'll be right back. That was Voice Squad with I Am from the album Rich and Famous. For more information, check out www.voicesquad.co.uk. Moving on to Saturday 23rd of May, and Cable Co will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Also on 23rd of May, an evening of wine, women and song will be performing at the Fiddlers in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £18 in advance. Finally, on to Sunday 24th of May, and the Eddie Martin Band will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 24th of May, and the Alfie Kingston Duo will be performing at the Hare on the Hill, which is at 41 Thomas Street North in Kingsdown, Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Cheers, Jeff, and more What's On next week. That's all from Dialect Radio this week. In the studio were Mary Tapping, an NUJ journalist, chatting about discovering the good life and holistic healing courtesy of the Credit Crunch. Thank you to Lux and Louis from the Bolsheviks, who hung around to let us play one of their tracks and chat about their music. They're going on a lovely tour around Cornwall. Sounds very nice. I'm quite jealous. Best of luck with that. And Josie Hill from the 125 charity to chat about their massive £5,000 award. Congratulations. And their night walk, Saturday the 13th of June. You can Google the 125 charity to find out more. O-N-E, the word one, and 25, the numbers. Thank you to Malcolm Grieve for reading The Innkeeper's Diary, chapter 4 next week. Features were by Tony Gosling and Anthony Page, just past Boris the Watson, and the studio engineer was Alistair Grant. The producer was Anthony Page, and next week we'll have choral players in the studio to entertain us.